This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
You are listening to Danger Zone, the latest news and opinion on terrorism, foreign policy, spy agencies, military, and national defense. Here are your hosts, retired Marine Colonel Bill Callen from Fox News and Ambassador Dick Carlson.
Hello, everyone. This is Danger Zone, and I'm Dick Carlson, and welcome to you. We're so glad you were with us today. I'm sitting with my co-host and good friend, Bill Callen, the retired Marine officer and Fox News military and terrorism analyst. Hey, Bill, nice to be with you this fine day.
And, Dick, it's always a privilege to be sitting in the studio with you and talking to people who we know and like and getting their opinions and some people hearing what we have to say. So it's always good to be here, Dick.
Excellent. We have Bill and I, folks, are tucked into a small studio high on the edge of Georgetown, looking out across rooftops to downtown Washington, D.C. and the White House. Appropriate because we talk about policy and we talk about action on this broadcast and how those two things affect America and the lives we lead. We have a couple of outstanding guests on this edition of Danger Zone. We are so glad you are with us to listen to them. One is Andrew McCarthy, the former prosecutor and current Dynamite writer. He's going to stand by. We'll be with him in just a moment. There are a couple of things I wanted to mention first, Bill. One thing, I saw a story this past week that the general who's investigating over the last 6 months or whatever, Bergdahl, Private Bergdahl, who's promoted to Sergeant right. Bergdahl, was basically thought to be a deserter by his confreres in his unit. The general has not released the findings of the investigation. I think it's personally kind of weird that a general is assigned to do the interrogation of this guy anyway. But he hasn't released it, and he has basically said, well, we're going to release it, but sometime in the near future. What do you think that might be, Bill?
You know, Dick, I think we all know it's political cover-up of this guy Bergdahl. I think ultimately the White House is going to want to declare this guy first off, the White House wants to put as good a spin on the Bergdahl story as they can, considering who they gave up to get Bergdahl back. And I think the reality is, by all accounts, that this guy was at a minimum a deserter, maybe possibilities that he was a traitor out there. I think this investigation is going to be pretty much whitewashed. They don't want it to impact negatively. The White House doesn't want to have to once more defend their actions for the five people that got away. And it's a tragedy. And I think ultimately, again, as I've mentioned before with you, the White House, the Pentagon, they're going to want to have this guy labeled as a prisoner of war. They're going to look for a rationale to do that, because that even makes their side of the story look so much better. POW, as you know, gets special benefits that Bergdahl's certainly not deserving.
If he's declared a POW, which flies in the face of all of the facts that I'm aware of, he gets a lifetime annuity. He gets to retire as a sergeant when he was a private when he first
exactly.
was captured or surrendered himself, whatever the facts are. And the five men that they gave away are from Guantanamo. Imminently dangerous people. They were required, that is the administration, to notify Congress with 30 days. They didn't do any of that. And I think they're fearful that there's going to be a replay on cable television of that ridiculous Rose Garden ceremony. And Susan Rice talking about how Bergdahl served with honor and distinction.
Right.
I think I have that quote right.
Yeah, you do.
There's no evidence that he served with either honor or distinction. And the president doesn't want Democrats smeared with something that they should be smeared with, he should be smeared with, I think.
I think the great irony is I don't think Susan Rice has served with honor and distinction either, but that's a separate story.
This has not been a particularly good week for the political CDC director, Dr. Tom Frieden. He's been all over television. You know, we've seen him talking about this Ebola crisis. I saw somebody on TV recently, Dr. Manny Alvarez, who said, right now I'm not as afraid of Ebola as I am of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. That probably is an exaggeration, but I am sort of concerned about the fact that the U.S. Embassy, and I've seen nobody focus on this, the U.S. Embassy in Liberia gave a temporary visa to an unemployed driver who turns out to have had Ebola, who wanted to come to Texas to visit his fiancée, quote, who hadn't seen in 12 years or something like that. And they gave him the visa. Why would they give a visa to someone like that? Why? There's nothing inherently wrong with him, but why is it in the interest of the U.S. government to give visas to people from the three countries that are now threatened seriously by Ebola, Cote d'Ivoire, Liberia, and Guinea? And they're doing 150 travelers a day from those countries are arriving on average in this country at airports. And now they're going to test people out at Dulles Airport. Who's going to test him? TSA? Well, they're so efficacious, of course.
Meanwhile, we have people who can't get visas in the past, such as the new Prime Minister of India.
Modi. He wasn't allowed in the United States.
And same as this wonderful man I work with in Iraq, the commanding officer of Iraq's Special Operations Forces, works side by side with Americans. He can't get a visa to come to the United States.
I think there's something wrong with some of the things in our system, and the administration is worsening it all, it seems to me.
I dare say.
Let's take a break. We have Andy McCarthy standing by. We'll be with him in just one moment.
Hey, Stacy. Have you noticed something different with the boys lately?
Yeah. Ever since John started reading DailyCaller.com, he's been a new man.
I know. Steve has seemed stronger, smarter, faster, more funny.
And is he keeping you up all night?
All night, with huge loads of information.
We should tell Marcia, too. I hear her Jim has been reading The Post, and, well, it's gotten a little dull.
It's easy to spice up your life. Just go to DailyCaller.com for all your news and entertainment. Daily Caller, it's the right thing to do.
Hi, folks. We have the impressive and knowledgeable Andy McCarthy standing by, as I promised. Andrew McCarthy III, former assistant district attorney for the Southern District of New York. He's known most famously for his successful prosecution of the 1995 terrorist. I can't believe it was that long ago. That was the blind Sheikh Omar Abdel Rahman. You'll remember he and 11 of his vicious cohorts were indicted by the government, and Andy prosecuted them. He also worked on the prosecution of the terrorists who bombed the U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania. Left the Justice Department back in 2003, now writes for National Review. He's a columnist, regular contributor. He's ubiquitous and well-known, and he's very strong intellectually. I used to work with him at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. I was co-chairman. I worked full-time for about 8 years there. And Andy led the FDD Center for Law and Counterterrorism. Well-respected guy. Author of a bunch of good books, by the way. Willful Blindness, a Memoir of the Jihad. Another one called The Grand Jihad, How the Left is Sabotaging America. How the Obama Administration has Politicized Justice. Oh, man, I guess. And this year, Faithless Execution, Building the Case for Obama's Impeachment. Andy McCarthy, welcome to Danger Zone.
Dick, Bill, it's great to be with you both.
Thank you. Thanks, Andy. You're here, too. Well, you know, I mentioned right before I introduced you, Bill and I were talking a little about the former Private Bergdahl, now Sergeant Bergdahl, about whom everyone is waiting to hear. Lots of people anyway, the administration's hoping they're forgetting it, waiting to hear the results of the investigation by the General Indem. What do you make of all of this?
Well, you know, I make of it personally some unfortunate timing, because the Bergdahl Taliban swap happened a few days, I think, after my book came out. And I had a lament that, you know, the problem with writing a book about presidential lawlessness in the Obama administration is that at a certain point in time, the writer has to stop writing, but the administration rolls merrily along. Yeah. So by the time the book came out, I was probably several impeachable offenses behind. And one of them is this particular instance, which, you know, I think in this episode, a lot of people in Washington, perhaps understandably, got themselves all whipped up about this 30-day notification statute that the administration hadn't given Congress notification that it was doing this transfer of these Taliban commanders. And it seemed to me that really missed the point, because in terms of presidential responsibilities and commander-in-chief responsibilities, this was a profound dereliction of duty, whether there was a statute involved or not, to replenish the enemy in wartime at a time when the Taliban is still conducting offensive terrorist operations against our guys in Afghanistan, to me, is about as shocking a dereliction of duty as it gets. And I think that, you know, the Bergdahl aspect of it makes it even worse. But, you know, I defer to Bill on this, but I think that even if Bergdahl had been Audie Murphy, we don't give terrorist commanders back in the middle of a war when the enemy is still killing our guys.
I haven't heard that point made clearly by anybody in the media other than you, and yet it's so obvious and sensible. It would be like during the Second World War, we capture Goering and Himmler, and they decide to give them back because the interested for they trade them in for some sergeant who defected. That's a good idea.
Yeah. Right. Well, I think, unfortunately, and I've had this experience now for a few months since the book came out, the reason no one in Washington wants to talk about it is it's an impeachable offense. I mean, it's dereliction of duty by the commander-in-chief in wartime. And since nobody wants to do anything about that, they just assume not talk about it. So we talk about the outrages around the edges, the violation of the statute, the fact that Bergdahl is probably almost certainly a deserter, and we don't get to the main point, which is that we're in the middle of a war with a commander-in-chief who at times seems like he's playing for the wrong team.
Well, at least he's out playing golf, so from his perspective, things aren't probably that bad. Andy, there's a recent report, we don't know if it's true yet or not, that the Taliban are now pledging their allegiance to ISIS. I wonder how that's going to change the dynamics about the Bergdahl story, probably to some degree.
Yeah, you know, I think it'll give fuel to it. It'll also raise the specter, which is something that we've been discussing for some time now. I was one of the people who said stay out of Syria, and my point in making that argument was that, you know, if al-Qaeda was going to square off against Hezbollah and you pitted Hamas actually against Iran and you had basically all of America's enemies divided against each other, and if they wanted to beat their brains in each other, we should have just let them do it. Now, the rise of ISIS creates, I think, different security issues for us because we know from past experience that if you give these al-Qaeda franchises, and ISIS is just really a renegade al-Qaeda breakoff group, if they get safe haven and they have it now like they've never had it before, they attack the United States, and we can't tolerate that happening. But one of the things I was always afraid about with Syria was if we got involved, the jihadists would put aside their internal internecine divisions and unite against us as they typically do. And I think that this is going to be a specter that we're going to see across the board. The more successful the Islamic State is, the more you'll see not only groups like the Taliban, but also some of these al-Qaeda franchises bury the hatchet of whatever problems they've had internally with the Islamic State. And they'll really, I think the enemy is going to coalesce here.
Folks, we are talking with the writer and former federal anti-terrorism prosecutor, Andy McCarthy. This is Danger Zone. I'm Dick Carlson with Bill Cowan.
Andy, you know, I tend to have a pretty careful eye on al-Qaeda and al-Nusra and all the bad guys out there. And then when Khorasan Group surfaced absolutely out of nowhere, it kind of caught many people by surprise, me included. I wondered why I hadn't heard of them before. They suddenly became the center of a major targeting effort by the U.S. military. And then you wrote this incredible piece. I'm still stunned by the brilliance that you showed in that thing. I mean, people, you know, I wouldn't expect
a
federal
piece.
Prosecutor. Yeah. I expected somebody from the intelligence community come rushing up and say, wait, this is all a bogus activity or bogus operation. Could you talk for us a few minutes about that? Because I think it's one of the most, it's just so darn good about how you laid the Khorasan Group, who or what they are out
there. I have
there.
To say, Andy, just as a sidelight, when I first read about the Khorasan Group, I thought it was somebody down on K Street, one of those PR outfit where everybody joins it when
yeah,
they
right.
leave the administration.
Yeah.
Dick, I'm afraid the way things are going, they'll be on K Street pretty soon. We're not more careful. But it's very kind of you to say. I think what we have seen over these last, let's say, 3 years, is this pattern, well, really, this goes back to the beginning of the administration, but certainly since Osama bin Laden was taken out by our special forces, what we've seen is Obama go out of his way to miniaturize the enemy. And one way of doing it is to basically not mention al-Qaeda other than to claim, as he did some three dozen times, that al-Qaeda's already been defeated. He took care of that. And, you know, they highlight the names of the internal franchises, cells, and you know, internal organizational chart divisions of al-Qaeda. And they tend to suggest to people that these are all individual groups scattered across the globe, not really unified by any overarching ideology, certainly not anything that you could call Islamic or Islamic supremacist ideology, just a bunch of little operations that are motivated by parochial and political concerns, not any big movement that's anti-Western or ultimately anti-American. And I think the Corazon business was of a piece with that. What the Corazon, to say that the Corazon group doesn't exist at all is probably an overstatement.
Right.
And as I elaborated in the piece, it's not that it doesn't exist, it's that it doesn't exist as Obama represented it, which was as a standalone terrorist organization that was suddenly not only a threat, but an imminent threat to the United States. And what the Corazon group really is what in Islamic ideology they call a shura. It's just an advisory board. It's a few experienced terrorists around the leader of al-Qaeda, Ayman Zawahiri, who, you know, basically give him advice and carry out his directives. They're not a combat unit as such. They're not much less a standalone terrorist organization. A number of them were sent to Syria in beginning around 2012, and that was, as you would expect, to fight under the auspices of the group called al-Nusra, which is al-Qaeda's franchise in Syria. But whether they call it Corazon or al-Nusra or Boko Haram or Ansar al-Sharia or all these other monikers they have, what people need to remember is it's all al-Qaeda, and the administration doesn't want to say al-Qaeda because that gets into, you know, well, if al-Qaeda is bigger and stronger and more threatening and still an imminent threat to the United States, then why did President Obama say 36 times that he had put it on the path to defeat and decimated it and defeated it and all the things he said about it? But I think this is a sustained effort to try to miniaturize an enemy which has actually gotten stronger in the last 6 years.
You know what's so interesting, Andy, is since those first strikes that were run against the Corazon group, their name has virtually disappeared from the media. They're not out there anymore. They were
right.
A big thing. I was on TV a whole bunch of times talking about them, trying to wiggle my way through who they were and what they were until I read your piece and the light went on for me. But it's just so interesting how it's disappeared.
Yeah, and notice what else has disappeared, Bill, which is al-Qaeda. You know, the only thing they're talking about in that area of the Middle East is ISIS.
Yes.
And one of the reasons for that is, as I pointed out in the same article, this vaunted coalition of Sunni governments that Obama put together only agreed to attack Islamic State targets. They wouldn't attack what were known as Corazon or Nusra or actually al-Qaeda targets.
Right, exactly.
And the reason for that is that these Sunni governments have been working together with those al-Qaeda units, and those are kind of the backbone of what the government wants to call the moderate Syrian rebels, which is, you know, part of why we have such a big problem figuring out who our friends are in that region. We just don't have that many of them.
We're talking, ladies and gentlemen, with author and former federal prosecutor Andy McCarthy. The show is Danger Zone, Dick Carlson and Bill Cowan. Andy, let me ask you this. The war against the West by radical Islam, why has it descended down into such a left-right tug, with conservatives and libertarians worrying about the attacks on the West, the left taking a very different view in many cases, chattering about Islamophobia and, oh, I don't know, blaming America for almost everything, for the creation of al-Qaeda, for instance. I heard someone say that the other day on MSNBC. What do you think that's all about?
Well, I think it's a rerun, Dick, of the of sort of the Cold War dynamic, where you had anti-communists and anti-anti-communists. I think that, you know, basically the people who were anti-communists then are anti-jihadists and anti-Islamic supremacists now, and the people on the left who were anti-anti-communists back then, who wanted Americans to believe that the bigger threat to the United States, the bigger threat to our liberties, was American overzealousness with respect to communism. They're the same characters now who are telling you that a bigger threat to our way of life is the overzealousness of people who are concerned about Islamic supremacism and the jihad than the jihadists themselves. And that's, I think that's been a theme that not only has been hammered by the left really almost since right after 9/11, and in my experience prosecuting the cases in the 90s, even before 9/11, but it's also been picked up by a strain of I think libertarian extremism that usually is thought to be housed on the right, and that has in some ways for colorable reasons I think suggested and pointed out that the American government's reaction to terrorism, because it's so politically correct, has frittered away people's liberty. So that, you know, for example, we're all subjected to indiscriminate searches at the airport when there's a very particular type of individual who fits the profile of the enemy, but we're not allowed to give that individual more attention because that would be, you know, insulting to Muslims or you know, politically incorrect. So I think this strain of anti-jihadism has some traction on the right and has been a big theme of the left, and that's the reason that it's played out the way it has.
That's a good explanation. I think you're probably right about that. It's the idea that the 80-year-old Jewish lady carrying a New York Times in her purse is as much of a threat as the guy wearing a scarf and a passport, say he just flew in from the United Arab Emirates.
Well, if she's reading the New York Times.
Well, that's true. I agree with that.
Andy, I have to ask you, is it only us outside the government who are concerned about the politicization, let me get that word right, of our government itself? I mean, you must have many, many contacts inside the Department of Justice and other places. Are there people still working inside this government who are worried about how the government's acting and where it's going? And when this administration is out, can we, if Republicans come in, can we hope for a turn back to the normalcy and the constitutionalism of our government?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I try not to get swept away, Bill, with the over-politicization of it, because there is a flip side to this, although it's rarely seen. We have a lot of really heroic people working on the front lines in both the law enforcement and the intelligence community. We still have the world's greatest military, even if some of the things that their commanders come up with, particularly I'm thinking after the Fort Hood debacle, for example, make you just scratch your head. But, you know, I think we have very good people who are patriotic, worried about the country, and trying to do the best they can, often against the directives that they're getting from Washington. And, you know, the other unfortunate thing that you have is you have ambitious people in the government, and look, ambition is not a bad thing. I'm not suggesting that for a second. But, you know, if they want to advance their careers, they kind of have to go with the flow and, you know, put their heads down and try to work their way through this next couple of years, just like they have the past several. And, you know, I'm thinking about, for example, when I was a prosecutor in the 90s, this whole insanity that we had with the wall, where we wouldn't allow the law enforcement community and the intelligence community to compare notes to better defend us against threats to the homeland. And it wasn't until after 9/11 that whole wall came down. But while it was there, it created an ethos in the government where even good agents were led to believe that their best course of action, if they wanted to advance their careers and stay out of trouble, was to do nothing. You know, it was so hard to share information that you were better off as far as your career advancement was concerned, not as far as our national security was concerned, just going with the flow. And you have to worry about how much of that is going on now, because the impediments to agents doing their jobs today are in some cases just like the wall was. I do think that cooperation between law enforcement and intelligence is much better today than it was when I was doing these cases, and that's a big part of the reason that we haven't been hit again like we were on 9/11. Those guys have done a great job. The scary thing is that the Obama administration is pushing against that kind of intelligence and prevention paradigm of counterterrorism. They would rather see the agents rather than, you know, gathering up intelligence in these communities where the threat is, work with our partners in Islamic organizations and let them be our eyes and ears and, you know, see how that works out.
You know, Andy, before we run out of time, I saw an interview on 60 Minutes recently with James Comey, who's the new FBI director. He's not so new, but hasn't been there too long. He may have noticed this. He told the world that American ISIS fighters, that is, Americans who have gone to join the enemy, have every right to come back to the United States if they want to. He said, ultimately, an American citizen, unless their passport is revoked, is entitled to come back. So somebody who has fought with ISIS, ISIL, he said, with an American passport and wants to come home, we'll track them very carefully. We will track them very carefully. This is a quote from the FBI director. There's something patently ridiculous on its face with that statement, do you think?
Well, you know, look, I know Jim Comey since we both started out as prosecutors 30 years ago, or close to 30 years ago, under Rudy Giuliani, and I actually I think very highly of him. And I saw the same thing you saw, and I think he was just acknowledging reality, which is that the FBI does not have any authority to arrest somebody simply because they've fought with ISIS. You know, American citizenship is not something that you can just strip. You actually have to, you know, conduct a legal proceeding against somebody in order to do that.
And I think Jim Comey was doing that. I think you're right. That's what he was doing. I think he probably should have said at the same time, if the Congress is offended, as I am personally offended by all of this, then they ought to enact a law that does something about it, yanks passports, accuses people of treason and so forth. He was being legalistic in a very legalistic world. We're out of time, Andy. It's so great to have you with us. We've been talking with Andy McCarthy. His latest book is Faithless Execution, Building the Case for Obama's Impeachment. As always, he delivers a clear and sensible analysis of complex issues. You're the best, Andy. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you, gents. It was a great pleasure.
Thanks, as always, Andy. We look forward to having you again.
Thanks.
Thank you. We'll take a break, ladies and gentlemen. We'll be back in just one moment.
This message was paid for by the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. The tide of war is not receding. On the contrary, the jihad threat is rising. Today, more than 40 Islamic terrorist groups operate in no fewer than 24 countries. The Foundation for Defense of Democracies is doing the hard work necessary to understand America's enemies, who they are, and how they can be defeated. FDD needs people like you, people who know why we have to fight and win. Go to defenddemocracy.org to learn more. Your support makes FDD's work possible.
Hello, everybody. This is Dick Carlson. I'm back with my friend and co-host Bill Cowan, retired Marine Special Forces operator, Fox News military and terrorism analyst. And we have a wonderful guest waiting here in the wings. Her name is Monica Crowley. I know you know who she is. She's an author. She's a political foreign affairs pundit, columnist, all-around lively public intellectual with something substantive to say. There's probably an acronym in there somewhere, SSSS. Before we get to Monica, a couple of stories of interest. But no, actually, we're not going to talk about anything. I want to get right to Monica now that she's here. Monica, let me tell you a couple things further about her, folks. She joined Fox News back when the channel launched, and that was in 1996. She's been an international affairs analyst since then. She began hosting the Monica Crowley Show on WABC Radio in New York. That was about 12 years ago. She's also on MSNBC as co-host of Connected Coast to Coast. She has a great CV. I told Monica a minute ago, I mentioned to my wife that she was going to be on the show, and my wife said, I really love her. She's so much smarter than most men. And I think she meant me. Anyway.
I know your wife pretty well. She probably meant me, too.
She probably did. Yeah.
We're going to enter this interview real quick here, Monica.
So, Monica, we're glad to have you with us today.
Yeah, thanks for joining us.
Well, it's my pleasure.
Yeah. Thanks so much for joining us, Monica.
My pleasure, and it's such an honor to be with both of you guys. I admire both of you so much, so thank you for having me.
Thanks, Monica.
Thanks. It's our privilege. Thursday, September 11th, you had a real nice piece in the Washington Times commentary section about what Obama's response to September 11th reveals. Blaming America for the attack is the mark of the radical left. Tell us a little bit about that, which we entirely agree with without having to reading any further.
Well, thank you. I appreciate you citing that column, and I do write a weekly column now in the Washington Times, and I'm their online opinion editor now, which is a fantastic job. But I actually wrote about Barack Obama's initial response to the 9/11 attacks in my book that came out 2 years ago called What the Bleep Just Happened. And I was stunned when I came across this because it didn't get a lot of attention in 2007 and 2008 when he first came on the national scene. And when I found it, I thought, this needs some amplification. People need to know what the very young Barack Obama was saying about the 9/11 attacks just 8 days after those attacks. So on September 19th, 2001, Barack Obama, who nobody knew who he was a very undistinguished state senator at the time in Illinois, and he penned an article for something called the Hyde Park Herald, a local paper in Chicago. That article, which again I wrote about in What the Bleep Just Happened, and again in my Washington Times piece a couple of weeks ago, I thought was incredibly revealing, not just about Barack Obama and the kind of commander-in-chief he ultimately ended up being, but also about the far left which he represents in the presidency. That article talked about, it essentially had a message that our enemies are people too, and that we need to really put the burden on ourselves, not on the enemy, but on ourselves to try to figure out the roots of this kind of terrorism, this kind of violence, that these people are incredibly poor, they have no opportunities. None of which were true.
That's completely untrue.
About the 19 hijackers on 9/11.
They all came from affluent families, educated people, and so forth. That's always untrue.
Correct. Correct. Most of the 9/11 hijackers were upper middle class. They were highly educated. They knew exactly what they were doing. And it called to mind two things. One, that this is the typical leftist view, that the burden should always be on the United States to explain, to apologize, to retrench, and to retreat because we're simply not worthy of our superpower status because we've committed all this theft and genocide and all these grotesque crimes in the course of our history. But the other thing that occurred to me as I was reading this is that this was going to be the philosophy that he was going to carry into his role as commander-in-chief, and we have certainly seen that happen.
Absolutely.
I talk about it all the time here. We have seen it to the great detriment not only of the United States and our place and security in the world, but also for all freedom-loving people around the world as well.
You know, Barack Obama, you wrote this once. I saved this quote. Barack Obama, war president, Middle Eastern war president, Iraqi war president, Syrian civil war president. Who would have thunk it? Certainly not President Obama himself with his unearned Nobel Prize sitting on his desk. Isn't that the truth?
It is. I mean, he never should have accepted that. If the man had any class and grace, when the Nobel Committee announced it, he should have said, I thank you for the thought. I'm going to turn it back or give it to members of the United States military as a whole who have really put their lives on the line for American security since 9/11. But no, he accepted it. And now he has actually launched more aggressive actions against more Muslim countries around the world than, frankly, any other president in American history. But what we have seen is that he spearheaded the attack in Libya when there was no aggression being committed by Gaddafi at the time. Gaddafi was a longstanding terrorist. We know he killed a lot of Americans. But by the time Obama became president, Gaddafi was actually working with us.
Yes, he was.
And delivering a lot of important intel on al-Qaeda, the Muslim Brotherhood, other Islamists across northern Africa. He goes in and helps to overthrow him. Same case with Mubarak, a longstanding U.S. ally, made peace with Israel, overthrow him as well. Now we've got the Syrian situation, and out of that, out of Obama's lack of action and constant dithering on that, now we have the rise of an Islamic caliphate spearheaded by ISIS. This president, because of that leftist philosophy he articulated after 9/11, that has come to life in so many ways, and it has completely collapsed the Middle East. Our interests are so far back now. Americans' lives are increasingly at risk because of this, and I think more and more Americans now are seeing that ever more clearly.
The situation with Gaddafi, I was just thinking that that was one of the great accomplishments of the CIA, was suborning Gaddafi and getting him to turn him into an asset of ours, which he was, and the president had to, and his Susan Rice
Yes, entourage. You know, you're exactly right about that. And that happened after George W. Bush, with his much maligned entrance into Iraq and the war in Iraq. Gaddafi took one look at what was going on with Saddam Hussein, and he said, oh, I don't want to be next. I don't want the American military to come into this country and overthrow me, and I don't want to have to stand trial, so what I'll do is I'll flip. And the CIA did a great job in flipping him. He was cooperating with us. He was trying to turn the Libyan economy around to a more capitalist kind of system. He was developing the Mediterranean coast with resorts and so on. And Obama went in and overthrew him. And the untold story, we're all focused on ISIS, guys, as we should be. But the untold disaster here is what's going on in Libya. Remember when President Bush went into Iraq and Colin Powell said to him, you break it, you own it? That was true, but that's yes. always true. And yet, Obama's not being held to the same standard. He went in, he broke Libya, overthrew the dictator, and now it is a growing cesspool of Islamist activity, to the point where Islamists have taken over the embassy and are swimming in our pool in Tripoli. And yet the press, which is so corrupt, as you know, is not reporting this. You have a failed state, thanks to us, in Libya, which is a growing hotbed and center of Islamic terror.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're talking with Monica Crowley. She is she's really an expert on international affairs, and she's a great foreign policy analyst. She holds two master's degrees, you should know that, and a PhD as well from Columbia. She's a very accomplished person, written lots of books, appears on lots of programs all of the time. We're delighted to have her with us, and you are shaking at the bit here.
I have to ask how the Columbia alumni feel about you, knowing Columbia for the school that it is. I'm sure.
Well, I'll have to tell you, when I was applying to graduate school, I was working for former President Richard Nixon during the last years of his life.
Well, that must have been a real boost in graduate school.
I just want to point out it was the last 4 years of his life, not when he was president. I was a mere embryo when he was elected. but I remember being, once I was admitted to the Columbia PhD National Security Program, I remember the first day of school, I walked in and all of these professors sort of came out of their offices. And they were all kind of looking at me, and some came over and introduced themselves, and they said, we wanted to see the Nixon girl.
Oh, my God.
And I said, excuse me, because I was working for him at the same time. I started graduate school. So they said, we wanted to meet the Nixon girl. And I have to say, to their great credit, I only had one or two truly out Marxist professors there. The others were incredibly fair to me. And President Nixon used to joke to me, you're still going to come out of Columbia conservative, right, Monica? And I would say, yes, Mr. President, yes, I will.
Well, you know, Monica, that does say a lot about you, your bravery going in there in what was most of us would consider to be a rather hostile environment. So,
oh, it
so,
was.
So good on you. You know, you wrote another great piece in the Washington Times about the jihadists out recruiting women, militants recruiting females as baby factories for future terrorists. And, of course, besides recruiting women, they've certainly stolen an awful lot, kidnapped an awful lot throughout that region.
Yes, and they're targeting American young women and also women in Western Europe. It's interesting. They've had a little more success in Western Europe, the UK and France, because there are bigger Muslim populations there, but also because Western Europe has largely become secular over the last 50 or 60 years. So there is a spiritual void in the West. And what these radical Islamists are doing are targeting women and men, but with women, you know, a lot of young people are looking for meaning in their lives, and now some of them are finding it through Islam, again, because so many of these societies are so thoroughly secular now. A lot of these women now are being recruited through social media. This is where the kids live, right? Twitter, Facebook, right. On their phones. They're being targeted in that way, and with women in particular, they're being wooed by promises of being taken care of by these jihadis and that they can create a family. What they really want is these women to come in and repopulate the caliphate, the new caliphate. So they are being brought in as baby factories, but some of them are also being put into checkpoints around the new Islamic State. to pat down other women and to enforce Sharia among women in the caliphate. So some women now, like these two girls from, I think it was Croatia, who are now pregnant and want to come back into, I think, maybe Austria. They want to come back, and the Austrians are saying, no way. Now they've realized that they've made a huge mistake. But that's not stopping the recruiting. The recruiting is ongoing.
Monica, I saw a story maybe a month and a half or 2 months ago in one of the London papers about a fellow over there that a lot of women in Europe particularly are attracted to. I think he went by, and he's an ISIS leader, I think his nickname was the Lion of the Desert or something like that. So I went and searched the web and found a picture, and I'll tell you what, the guy looks like he's right out of the movies. And I mean, he's a tough-looking guy, but he's a handsome guy, and you could see why women would be attracted and drawn to somebody like that. I used to be a pretty big motorcycle guy. I always wondered why these women were attracted to hardcore bikers, but I have to tell you, it worked. So, you know.
Well, you know what?
What does that mean?
I can tell you that, yes, women, for the most part, can be attracted to the bad boy, but there are bad boys on the motorcycle, and then there are really bad boys,
exactly,
like ISIS. I do think that there is some of that, what they're calling jihad chic, again, trying to fill a spiritual void in a lot of these secular countries. I also think, you know, I was telling a friend of mine the other day, we're watching Orange is the New Black, which is fantastic. I was a huge fan of Breaking Bad, a huge fan of the Sopranos, but then it occurred to me that these shows are so brilliant and you take them as entertainment, but the danger is you end up cheering for the bad guy, right? You're cheering for Tony Soprano. You're cheering for Walter White. You're cheering for the women in prison in Orange is the New Black. I think there's a real corrosive effect that's going on there where it sort of normalizes criminality, in this case terrorism, And it's blurring the lines, and I think there's something to that as well.
I agree totally. They tend to overlook the brutality and the viciousness of it, and they see the romance of the whole thing, and it makes good sense
to
them.
Right, and then when they get to the reality of it, there really is no romance.
You'll remember that one of the Sarnoff brothers, or however you pronounce it, the Boston bomber, the one who died, he was married to a woman who was switched to the Muslim faith, the daughter of a small-town Rhode Island doctor, as I remember this, and she had a child by him, and she wore a scarf around her head and was reclusive, and while he apparently was a murderer beyond what he had done with the bombing. He'd killed some people otherwise and so on, but she had been seduced by whatever the kind of masculinity some Chechen radical would offer, I guess.
Yes, that's exactly right. And she's still, I think now she's living in New Jersey with one of the Tsarnaev sisters, and has hooked up with another Muslim man. But when you talk about the glamorization of this, his younger brother was put on the cover of Rolling Stone, and he started getting a lot of female fan mail coming in. That is beyond any explanation to me, psychologically. But again, I think it's this romanticizing of these guys who are carrying out these abhorrent acts, and somehow people get a warped vision of them.
Indeed, I saw it as a young reporter covering things that often had to do with prisoners, where every prisoner, the Charlie Manson prisoners, there was a man named Tex Watson, you may recall, was instrumental in murdering people, and he was pursued by a lot of women, and who wrote to him in prison, and then moved to the town where the prison is in California. One of them married him and still lives there, and they have conjugal visits and all this kind of weirdness. You need a psychiatrist to take it all apart, I'm sure.
Yes, I know. It's beyond my explanation, but it does point to the need for the FBI, local law enforcement, to really be watching these communities and watching these mosques. I know I live in New York City, and one of the first things that our far-left new mayor, Bill de Blasio, did was strip the NYPD's counterterrorism unit, which has been so effective after 9/11. I mean, Rudy Giuliani, Bill Bratton, Ray Kelly built a tremendous apparatus here in the city of New York, and de Blasio came in and stripped them of their ability to really monitor these mosques. He called it racial profiling, you know, the typical leftist view on this. Well, that kind of political political correctness is going to hurt us and may, in fact, get us killed. I mean, even now with the Ebola crisis, the Obama administration doesn't want to stop flights originating from West Africa or even barring individuals who are originating from West Africa, maybe flying to Europe and then on into the United States because they're afraid that it might be called racist or something. Guys, we have to stop this, whether it's on Ebola or Islamism. We have to strip away the political correctness because we're going to have to at some point. I just hope it's before a catastrophic event and not later.
Well, Monica, they have set up at Dulles Airport in Washington this past week screening for people coming in from Guinea, from Liberia, from Cote d'Ivoire, the three countries that are being decimated by Ebola. Rather than stopping them, stopping the flights, rather than stopping them from coming in, other than diplomats or something like that, they're letting in people like this fellow Duncan who brought Ebola into the Texas hospital, and they gave him a visa at the embassy in Monrovia, Liberia. He's an unemployed driver who wanted to come and visit his, quote, fiance, a woman he hadn't seen in a dozen years. So they gave him a temporary visa. Why would they do such a thing? Why would they, knowing
right.
what's
well,
going on
well,
there?
Exactly right. And we're still doing it, by the way. Even
oh, yeah.
now after today, and we've got the second case of another nurse who cared for Mr. Duncan has now come down with Ebola, and their reports are that she was on a flight just a couple of days ago, 2 days ago, from Cleveland to Dallas, the day before she started showing symptoms. So now Frontier Airlines is trying to contact everybody who was on that flight. I mean, this could have the potential to blow up into a major public health crisis as well as national security crisis, and the Obama administration is sitting on his hands. Dr. Frieden, the head of the CDC, he's out front and center, but he's made a lot of mistakes, and the public feels like they're not getting accurate and timely information on this, so there is some panic starting to develop. But where is the head of the NIH? Where is the acting surgeon general? Where is the country has an Ebola czar, somebody who is in charge of bioterrorism and these kinds of potential outbreaks. Her name is Dr. Nicole Laurie. Where is she? She's
yeah.
part of HHS. We have not seen any of these people, and with the exception of the president saying maybe one or two statements over the last week or so, we haven't heard from him either. I mean, this is yet another example of the collapse of credibility of the federal government here. And I think my column in the Washington Times tomorrow, and I encourage everybody to check it out, is going to be on this issue because I think this Ebola crisis is really the straw that's breaking the camel's back in terms of how the American people view this presidency, his administration, and big government in general.
Well, we can only hope that it has an impact on the elections coming up. I was going to say answer your question about where are they. I know where they are. They're all just like Bo Bergdahl, AWOL. And probably going to have some report at some point that admonishes that releases of any burden for their misgivings. I have to go back real quickly to the counterterrorist unit, an intelligence unit that you had up there in New York, Monica. De Blasio's dismantling that, as you just suggested, is going to cost American lives, in my judgment, at some point. And part of the problem now is that when he goes out, if a Republican comes in and tries to reinstitute that, before there's been an attack, the media is going to be all over him. It's going to be a vicious attack from the left for trying to do what will be called racial profiling, and which in effect and in actuality is trying to protect Americans. And we're going to have to suffer yeah. casualties before people accept that.
One of the mayor's closest advisors, as Monica well knows, is Al Sharpton. Al Sharpton is yeah. close to de Blasio. De Blasio, whose name is not even de Blasio. He used to be, his name is like Wilfred Willens or something, and he changed it to de Blasio so he could sound Italian for some political reason, I guess. The whole thing is bizarre. Married a woman who was claimed she was a lesbian. Then she decided she wasn't, I guess, and has an aide paid $170,000 a year, I read the other day in the paper, who works for the first lady, the former lesbian who is no longer a lesbian, and is a person who lives with an ex-convict who'd been convicted of murder, who's a drug dealer, all of this, and the mayor just shrugs his shoulders and won't do anything about it.
I mean, it's unbelievable. I don't care what de Blasio does in his personal life. I don't care who he's married. All I care about is his public policy. And like you say, his wife's top aide is incredibly corrupt. She's married to or living with this former gangbanger, killer, and she failed to report it on her, you know, disclosure forms, and nothing is happening to her. This is public corruption at the highest levels. And not only that, But to strip the counterterrorism unit of all of its tools when New York remains the number one target, and we know that the border is wide open, terrorists could get in here, we know they're trying to weaponize Ebola, we know they're trying to get their hands on nuclear material and other WMDs, and yet this mayor, this president, they run around as slaves to political correctness, and the rest of us are so vulnerable here. And I literally hope, we survive the next 2 years of this president. And being a citizen of New York City, I literally hope I survive the next 3.5 years of this mayor.
You can't make this stuff up. When you think that Al Sharpton has admission and is often at the White House with the president of the United States, often with the attorney general, even though Al Sharpton is such a charlatan, and he is consulted on a serious level. And yet we have this motive. We were talking earlier, the new prime minister of India denied admission to the United States until he became the prime minister, Modi. And yet you give visas out to people who are carrying the Ebola virus. If you are a conspiracist, which I am not, you could easily see conspiracies at work here. My God, to destroy the country. It's amazing. I can see.
Well, in what the bleep just happened, which came out a little over 2 years ago now, I was writing all about the Obama first term. And as I was writing it, and when the book came out, I thought, okay, well, it can't get any worse than this. When I look back at this book and Obama's first term, all of those horrors, from socialized medicine to the stimulus and the $1 trillion-plus annual deficits and all of the insanity of the first term looks like Mickey Mouse stuff compared to now what's going on in the second term.
Totally
with the
does.
Rise of ISIS, right?
Yeah. Oh, completely.
I mean, the rise of the Islamic Caliphate, Ebola now, the wide-open border and the border crisis, all the stuff in the first term looks like small stuff compared to what's going on now. Every time you think it can't get worse under this president, it does.
Folks, we're talking to Monica Crowley. We're so delighted she's been here. We're running out of time. Monica, thank you so much for being with Bill and me. It was great.
Always a pleasure, guys. Anytime. I so admire both of you. Keep up the great work.
Talk to you sometime.
Thanks so
soon.
Much,
thank
Monica.
You. Folks, we're going to take a break and be back right after this.
Fall is in the air, and it's riding time again on the Blue Ridge Parkway. If you've been there on your bike, you know what I mean. Don't have one of your own? No sweat. Take a look at Classic Iron in Fredericksburg. Classic Iron specializes in previously owned motorcycles of all makes and models, including Harley-Davidson, Honda, Yamaha, and more. Classic Iron has been in business for over 25 years and has one of the largest selections of motorcycles on the East Coast, and they've got financing too. Check them out at classiciron.com.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome back. We're so glad you are with us. This is Dick Carlson, and I'm sitting here with my friend Bill Cowan, retired Marine officer and special forces operator. And the show is Danger Zone. As you know, we just had an interesting conversation with Monica Crowley, I have to say. In the subject of the Marine Corps, which my co-host is an expert on, having spent so many decades with the Marine Corps, the commandant of the Marine Corps just retired, General Amos. And I was surprised when he was appointed as commandant a few years back because he's a Marine aviator. They never had a Marine aviator. There's nothing wrong with Marine aviators at all. They're a laudable group in my view, and I know in Bill's view too. But they have never been chosen as commandant, I suspect, because they're not ground pounders. They're not infantry officers. And now it's been learned. Actually, I heard it from Bill Cowan a week or two ago. The General Amos, front page of the newspaper the other day, lied on his resume, and he said that he went to all office Marine officers go to basic school. You went to basic school, right?
I did.
Obviously. That he actually didn't go to basic school, and he said he took a correspondence course, which on its face is somewhat ridiculous because it's a tough 6-month school where they're carrying 80-pound packs and they're
I remember
doing all these things.
Anyway,
so what do you think? You know this.
Let me say this, Dick.
Well,
there was a period of time when aviators, Marine aviators, during the war, when there was a real crisis about getting aviators into the cockpit and getting them to war, Vietnam War. There was a period of time when Marine aviators did take basic school by correspondence. But he didn't fit into that criteria.
He was a naval officer, actually.
He was a naval officer, exactly. He was a naval officer who transitioned to the Marine Corps, then got out of the Marine Corps and became a commercial airline pilot, and then came back into the Marine Corps. Well, from Marine Corps perspective, at least during my day and certainly up until recently, that was a no-no. I mean, if you got out, that's fine. You got out and came back, we're glad to have you back. But you have cut your time. You don't compete now with that guy next to you who stayed in the Marine Corps from day one and fulfilled all of his obligations. And also, you don't You know, other guys went to, you don't, as an aviator, become the commandant of the Marine Corps, because the Marine Corps has historically, from day one, been an infantry-type organization. So we had never had an aviator become commandant.
They probably never will have again.
I don't believe we had ever had anybody with broken service. I may not be right. I don't think. There's nobody I know that had broken service and became commandant. So him being appointed as commandant, from the get-go, there was something in it that just didn't quite fit the mold of everybody else. And that irritated a lot of Marines, I'm certain. But what brought this particular case up was not that. What brought this case up was a Marine lawyer, former Marine lawyer, who was really irritated at undue command influence in legal proceedings against Marines. And this commandant violated every principle of standing aside and letting your subordinates be the investigating officer, be the convening authority, being all the things that the normal legal process for a Marine ought to be. This commandant got involved in a number of cases, and this irritated this former Marine lawyer who went in and started digging and found out. This, I have to admit, General Amos submitted a resume to Congress which was wrong, flat out wrong. And when questioned about it, his Marine Corps lackeys then started defending it and actually made comments to the media and maybe to Capitol Hill that were not correct. So this story's not over, even though Amos is out of the Marine Corps.
Indeed. We're out of time. This has been Danger Zone. We're so glad to have had you with us. Our producer, Janice Ockershausen, assistant producer, Helen Hocknell. This is Dick Carlson for Bill Cowan. Hey, listen, tune in again next week. We'll have interesting guests. And go to our website, DangerZoneRadio.com, and on Facebook, Facebook.com, Danger Zone Radio Show. Bill and I also have a new novel out. It's a parody. It's called Snatching Hillary, about the kidnapping of Hillary Clinton before the New Hampshire primary in 2016. You wouldn't want to trade places with the kidnappers. I think you'll think it's funny. See you next week.
You've been listening to Danger Zone, your place to get the latest news and opinion on terrorism, foreign policy, military, and national defense. Your hosts, retired Marine Colonel Bill Cowan from Fox News and Ambassador Dick Carlson. Listen every Saturday at 7 a.m. here on 1500 AM.